And we do have a long agenda. We do want to hear everything everyone has to say, but we're going to ask you to be as succinct as possible, and if you can keep your testimony to 2 to 3 minutes, we would appreciate that. We are going to begin this morning with Father John Estrom, Bishop Peter Rognes, and Rabbi Olitsky. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Father John Estrom. I am the CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. Catholic Charities is the largest provider of social services in the Twin Cities. Each year we serve about 40,000 people, regardless of faith. Many believe that in times of community and societal crisis, it is the faith and charitable organizations that will step up and meet the need. We do all we can, but the reality is this. For instance, in January, we provided over 6,600 nights of sleep at the Dorothy Day Center, just down the street here from the Capitol. It's one of our shelters in St. Paul. That's hundreds more than in December. And we anticipate that trend will continue long after the economy recovers. The mats that our clients sleep on are placed so close together that you cannot walk between them. Obtaining a bed or a 3-inch mat to sleep on is really only one barrier that the poor face. We know those who live in poverty and who are homeless have increased health risks and problems. An article by the University of Minnesota researcher published in the latest Minnesota Medicine reported that homeless patients stayed 4.1 days or 36% longer per hospital admission on average than other patients, even after adjustments were made for clinical and demographic characteristics. That's a lot of taxpayer and hospital charitable dollars that likely could have been saved with early intervention. We know that a relatively small investment of money and time can keep someone out of poverty and will pay dividends to the state in the long run. Mabel was a nursing student who lacked health insurance and learned that she was pregnant. The staff at our prenatal program connected Mabel with state-funded insurance for her and her daughter. Because of that, she was able to stay in school and to pay for the health care for her and for her daughter. She will now graduate from college, she will get a job, and she will pay taxes. We cannot imagine taking away health care coverage for the people who come through our doors. We cannot fathom the disaster if coverage for mental health care ends. But the conversation we must have isn't about cutting health care or early childhood education or affordable housing or higher education. The problems we face won't be solved this biennium simply by keeping intact funding. We must look at the long-term picture. We must have tough conversations about long-term comprehensive health care and social services reform. We know that you lawmakers face very tough decisions, and we know there are going to be cuts. We're willing to meet with both sides of the aisle to have tough conversations about the situation we find ourselves in. I'm not here to recommend specific policies. That's the responsibility of you who are lawmakers. But I believe that you must hear the voices of those who are heard the least and suffer the most. The hundreds who sleep on the floor of the Dorothy Day Center, who stand in line for food, or who wonder whether they can afford health care, are us. We must ask the question, what kind of state do we want Minnesota to be? Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Welcome.
I'm Peter Rognes. I serve as Bishop of the St. Paul Area Synod, the East Metro Area, for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. I'm grateful for this time, for this hearing. I don't envy you the task that you have before you, it's our task. We're all in this together. This isn't, I think, a government budget issue solely. It's the shape of our life together in this state that's at issue, and we have to make choices, and the choices are based on the long-term view of what kind of state we want to be, what kind of human community we want to shape here. A budget is fundamentally a moral document. It shapes who we are and the kind of choices we make for the life we have together. The point that I want to make here in these couple minutes, now and again when I end, is that I don't want you to do just a legislative numbers job. I want you to enlist all of us in the job of shaping life in this state. It's not just your problem. There are human lives at stake in every choice we make. The governor's budget proposal finds a lot of one-time money, and then it makes $2.5 billion in cuts, over half of which come from health and human services, the very safety nets we put under people's lives when the bottom drops out. These are people's lives that we're talking about. They're our neighbors, and they need, at specific times in their lives, help from neighbors like us. We do it in a lot of ways. We do it in churches. We do it in agencies. But the only way we can do it broadly, the only vehicle we have as a people in this state for doing it for all who have need, is the vehicle that we claim as government. It's our vehicle. I believe the people in this state want us to be the kind of neighbors who care, and I think the budget has to be the vehicle to do that. When people can't stretch budgets for food, we set up food banks. We do it in churches. Two Lutheran churches and a Catholic church in Dakota County that I was talking with the other day set up a food bank. A year ago, they were serving 300 families a month. Last month, it was 1,300 families. Human needs don't simply go away when funds get cut. When health care is eliminated, people won't stop getting sick. If we eliminate health coverage from 100,000 people, they will still get sick. They'll probably get sicker before they get help, and when they go for help, the cost will be borne by the institutions who will need to recover the cost from insurance premiums, and we all pay, and the sick health care system spirals even further out of control. That's neither humane nor enlightened way to make the choices. It's chaotic, and it pushes thousands of people to the side. When people lose their homes, as many are, they don't find a spot under a bridge, although some of them do. They bail in wherever they can, to apartments, to family, to friends, a few weeks or months at a time. They move from here to there. My wife teaches at a public school on the east side of St. Paul. I talked with the principal the other day, who said that the two buses that normally bring special ed and homeless kids in have now been increased to three. There's a 44% increase in the number of homeless children in St. Paul Public Schools alone. We have thousands of kids in this state going to our schools. It's chaos, and the budget slices homeless services. We're a humane people, I think. I don't think the people of this state want these results. I think we're seeing signs in this economic crisis time that the old arguments about government good or bad, taxes good or bad, they're being set aside, and we're focusing on what needs to happen and who needs to step up to make it happen. So here's what I ask. Ask all of us to step up. I think churches and other agencies are doing it, but only government can have the reach to affect broadly the shape of life in this state. The Legislative Commission to End Poverty has a vision of moving long-term to eliminate the need for people to live in poverty. I think this budget moves us in the opposite direction, and I think people in this state overall embrace the vision. So here's what I'm asking. Don't leave us on the sidelines to simply watch who gets sliced as the choices get made. Invite us to invest in this state. I'm not afraid of revenue increases if it means that people can go to a doctor if they're sick, if children have a safe place to be, if families who lose their homes have help finding a place to stay. The measure of our moral fiber as a people is how we treat the people who need our help the most. They're working at it themselves. Most of them are working, the working poor. If they're not, they wish they were, and a lot of them are kids, lots of kids. You need to shape this state on behalf of all of us. Ask us to help in our jobs, in our churches, in our agencies, and through the revenue we need as a whole people to do the job we need to do to be the kind of people we want to be in this state. I'm grateful for your work. I pledge our help. Help us be the kind of people that Minnesota is proud to be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bishop. Are there questions? Rabbi?
Rabbi Olitsky was unable to be here this morning. My name is Rabbi Jared Sachs. I'm one of the associate rabbis at Temple Israel in Uptown Minneapolis. In the annual cycle of Torah readings in the Hebrew Bible, we've just completed this section of text that recounts our exodus from Egypt. And in retelling that story no fewer than 36 times in the Hebrew Bible, we are reminded to care for the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, because we were strangers to Pharaoh in the land of Egypt. Whether the story is true or metaphorical, the reality is that each and every one of us at some point has been a stranger, has been among the most vulnerable for whatever reason. And that having had that experience means that we have the moral obligation to take care of others who are in that situation. It's not an issue of choice, but rather one of obligation. We speak in Jewish tradition of tzedakah, which often gets translated as charity. But in Hebrew, tzedakah is related to the word tzedek, which means justice. And it is actually something that we are commanded to do. The Torah commands us to, when we were an agricultural people, to leave the corners of our fields for the poor. And nowhere in the Hebrew Bible does it tell us to give money to the poor, but rather that we are supposed to leave things for them, because what we think we possess actually belongs to God. And the poor are the ones who collect the lien on God. The poor, God holds the lien, and the poor are the ones who get to collect. And we don't possess anything. In fact, we owe what we give to God, and it's an obligation to share it. The state must be involved in providing for the welfare of its citizens and help in repairing the world. The moral responsibility is upon each of us to ensure that the most vulnerable of us are not abandoned at their time of greatest need. In Pirkei Avot, a section of the Mishnah called translated as the ethics of our ancestors, Rabbi Tarfon says, Lo alecha hamlecha ligmor, velo ata ben chorin lehibatel mimena. You are not required to complete the task, but neither are you free to desist from it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Reverend Dotson.
Would you rather sit up here? Yeah, thanks. Good morning, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm honored to have this opportunity to testify. I've served as a psychologist and now a Presbyterian minister. And there's two populations that I'm very concerned about with the governor's proposed 10% cut in health and human services: people living with HIV/AIDS and people that are victims of crime and their families. Many of you have probably seen the play and the movie Rent. My conversion experience into HIV/AIDS ministry came in New York City in 1995, which is the time that Rent is covering in New York. That's when ARVs were not introduced yet, and AIDS was a terminal illness, not a chronic illness. And if you go to Blockbuster and rent the movie version of the play, you'll see a support group, and they sing to each other, "Will I lose my dignity? Will someone care?" I've provided for you two handouts, one that addresses the issue of HIV/AIDS, one about assistance to crime victims. In the state of Minnesota, 68% of the new HIV infections are among people of color. The leading cause of death of African-American women is HIV/AIDS. Most of us, when we think of HIV/AIDS, we think of the gay community, and we think of sub-Saharan Africa. There's a crisis in the African-American community, and as elected officials and as faith partners, we have to confront it. And with a 10% cut in health and human services, I fear that the prevention and services are going to be compromised. One of the variables that we need to address is that a large percentage of our incarcerated citizens are people of color. And I'm working with Senator Dibble to see if I know that financial implications this year are tough. And I know that the HIV prevention bill in this committee is probably not going to be moving very far. But if there's a way to revisit the HIV prevention and services in our correctional facilities, because when these men are released, if they don't know their HIV status and they go back into their communities, that's very vulnerable to women of color. And my colleagues in LA, where I served for 3.5 years, and my colleagues here see that as a critical variable to assess when you're looking at the issue of this alarming rate in the African-American community. And the other point I wanted to lift up was for crime victims. There's an article in the Pioneer Press a couple days ago about the cuts to the assistance that's offered to crime victims' families. I've been here 7 months after 3.5 years in LA, and I've worked with over 30 families who've lost a loved one to homicide. And putting on the psychologist cap for a moment, the folks that are grieving the loss of a loved one to homicide are at increased risk for post-traumatic stress, complicated grief, and often suicide. And if these funds are cut from the crime victims assistance, Health and Human Services is going to be a critical supplement for these families. And the tears and sobs of grieving mothers haunt me. We got to do everything we can so that these mothers have the emotional and spiritual support after they bury their loved one. I agree that this is a moral document. Our budget's a moral document. We cannot balance a budget on the backs of the least among us. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend, and thank you all for coming. I am sure that having heard your words today will be the best part of my day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call on Jessica Webster, Lisa Thompson, and Debbie Zesmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, which is part of Legal Aid. Legal Aid represents thousands of low-income Minnesotans across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Unfortunately, Legal Aid is, we're saddened and, quite frankly, we're quite frightened by how devastating these cuts could be to thousands of low-income Minnesota families and children. I'm here today to talk about MFIP. My colleagues over the next few days will be here to talk about health care. When MFIP was piloted in the 90s, there was so much hope. We finally thought we knew how to move kids out of poverty, change families' lives, change children's lives. And this budget today reflects such a huge step backwards at such a terrible time. The proposed cuts to MFIP starting at budget page 49, and also I'm going to talk about what I'm referring to is also 50 and 51, would mean thousands of families lose some assistance, others lose all assistance, and the door would be closed to many Minnesotans falling on hard times for the first time. We're particularly concerned about the $125 SSI penalty that would be imposed on MFIP grants of parents and children with disabilities. In all honesty, Legal Aid was prepared for cuts coming this session, and I think that we thought that there would be some administrative cuts to MFIP services, maybe a temporary suspension of employment and job services, higher caseloads, or other administrative cuts. What we weren't prepared for was a cut that would take money from 7,000 of the state's most vulnerable families. They're not only poor families, they're often disabled and ill families. For example, we represent a mom with a 4-year-old son with a severe seizure disorder. Mom's been in and out of work because her son is hospitalized so often. That $125 per month penalty would mean imminent eviction and homelessness for her and her son. And if I had 20 minutes, I could have 40 more stories just like it. And on a more technical point, we hope that the state will do a really careful analysis of how these cuts may jeopardize our chances to receive emergency economic stimulus TANF funding, and also how these cuts might affect the state's work participation rate and put us at risk for future TANF penalties. In closing, when you're making these difficult budget decisions, we really hope that you won't look for big savings from those who can afford it the least. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Webster, thank you for those comments. I just came from a meeting with the regional directors for workforce development, and they also were very, very concerned about the MFIP cuts, and especially about reinstating the requirement of the 20-hour work week and how difficult this makes it for them to have success. And they have numbers of cases of great success and people getting off of the welfare rolls and back into the workforce and being productive in the community. And so the cuts that we're making to MFIP are particularly difficult at this time.
Thank you, Senator Prettner-Solon. Any other questions? If not, we'll go on, Lisa.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come here today to this morning to voice my objections to the proposed cuts in the reimbursement rates for child care for low-income families and the proposed increases in the co-payments that these parents make. It's interesting that I follow commentary on the cuts to the MFIP because many of our families may be forced to go back onto those programs because they can't afford to pay for their child care. My name is Lisa Thompson. I've been a home-based family child care provider in Ramsey County for over 15 years. I'm also president of the union here for family child care providers called Family Child Care Providers, CCPT, or Child Care Providers Together, CCPT. I've been hearing from a lot of family child care providers about their reactions to the proposed cuts in the reimbursement rates. I've heard disbelief, frustration, and outrage at what the cuts will do to the families that we serve and our businesses. I have already experienced a dramatic decline in my business with our souring economy. One-third of my families have experienced a job loss over the past several months. This job loss then, in return, causes me to lay off my assistant. If I have to take another 3% cut in the reimbursement payments that I receive, then I'd be also forced to lay off my part-time helper. Even without the 3% cut, the state reimbursement rates are right now below the market rate for child care. As reported on the DHS website, in 2007, the maximum reimbursement rates covered only 55% of providers' rates, regular rates, and that's down from nearly 70% just 3 years before. This leaves either the parent to pay the extra on top of their co-pays or for the provider to simply absorb the loss. We simply cannot afford more loss to absorb. And now the governor's proposal is also to add more burden to these low-income families receiving assistance by increasing their co-pays by 3%. These are families going to work every day but still struggling to stay above the poverty line, but they are. And I've heard time and time again from parents and from other providers that families are just barely holding on now as it is. And I ask you to please consider and know that these cuts to child care reimbursement programs will force some families even deeper into poverty and more dramatically burden our state's other human services, much more than the 3% savings, or 3% saved by the cuts. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
I'll try not to take too much time, but I think this is such an urgent area, again, with the cuts in child care. Again, it's a complex situation, but you're already challenging a very vulnerable and challenged group and making it more difficult for them to be successful. And then what's happening is that we are not producing the people that are needed to carry on the workforce as baby boomers are also retiring from the workforce. And we're affecting our job market. We're affecting the livelihood of and the well-being of these vulnerable individuals. I just think that the whole thing is very complex, and we had just built up the supports that were necessary in order to make the program successful again, and now we're finding it eroding again.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, just quickly to expand what Senator Prettner-Solon said, I think it's the difference between a downward spiral and an upward spiral. I mean, all of these supports that we've put in place have been not just to help the people involved, which is very important, but also because it does, in the long run, help our economy. And when we start pulling these supports out, we're kind of going the opposite direction the federal government's trying to go and positioning ourselves just toward a downward spiral in the future.
Okay, thank you very much. Debbie Zismer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Zismer. I am the Director of Early Childhood Education at the YWCA of Minneapolis. The YWCA operates three early childhood education centers. We serve approximately 300 children and their families every year. Of those families, 82% identify as families of color, 73% are identified as low income, and 67% receive child care assistance in some form. Cuts to our in 2007 and in 2008, 100% of the children that we sent through to kindergarten from our program tested ready for school. And I'm sure you all know that the state rates are 60%. So we're well above that in the quality that we offer. What's going to happen with the cuts to the proposed cuts to the budget is that we're going to have to cut our programming. The quality of our program is going to go down. Fewer children are going to be ready to learn when they get to school because of that. And the way we're going to have to cut quality, we're already running extremely lean. Most child care centers do run very lean. We're going to have to get rid of some staff. That means we're going to have to be laying off some of our people. That means that the consistency of care that the children are providing, because we're going to be moving teachers around from room to room depending on where the need is to meet the ratios, that consistency isn't going to be there for those children when they need it the most. A lot of our children are suffering chaos in their home right now, and they need the consistency that is provided to them during the day with us to be ready to learn and to maintain their readiness to learn. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you all for coming. Next, we'll take Susie Brown, Kathy Barr, and Patrick Lloyd. You can go ahead and start.
Thanks. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susie Brown, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We're an advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain affordable, high-quality child care for the families and communities of Minnesota. We work with child care providers, parents, early childhood educators, after-school program providers, and others in order to advocate for a system of care and education that provides access, affordability, and quality for all of Minnesota's families and their children from birth through school age. I'm here today to discuss the impact of the proposed cuts to child care assistance on families, providers, and communities. Families must have care for their children in order to work. A modest investment of child care assistance for a family could mean the difference between being able to stay employed or leaving their job. We know that increased copays can make care unaffordable for some families, and cuts to reimbursement rates may drive some providers out of business. Both of these proposed cuts can have the effect of reducing access to child care for families, forcing them to choose between leaving the workforce or finding alternative care for their children. Some families may be able to move into alternative care settings with families, friends, or neighbors, or leaving their younger children in the care of older siblings. Others will care for their children themselves, leaving the workforce or reducing work hours to do so. In today's economic environment, any assistance to stay in the workforce will be an investment to strengthening families, communities, and the economy. Families who benefit from the child care assistance program are financially stressed and often experience instability in resources in housing, education, health, food, and other basic needs. Positive, safe, enriching, and consistent environments for children are important for stressed families and help children, whether they're newborn, preschool age, or older children during after-school hours, experience safety, constructive learning environments, and consistency in adult relationships. These are components of healthy development and should be a priority for Minnesota. Providers who care for children using the Child Care Assistance Program represent Minnesota's small businesses. They operate in communities throughout the state, meeting the demand of families, providing employment, paying business taxes, and stimulating the economy. Reducing their payment for service threatens their business model. And if they go out of business, it's detrimental not only to their livelihood and the care needs of the families they serve, but to local economies and communities. We understand that the budget deficit is dire and that no programs are likely to be spared from cuts. But we ask that when you make the difficult decisions required to balance the budget, you consider the benefits that the Child Care Assistance Program brings to the state in helping parents stay employed, providing positive environments for children, and helping the small businesses that serve them stay economically viable.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there questions? Ms. Barr?
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Barr, and I'm the CEO of Bethesda Hospital. I'm also a vice president within the Health East Care System, and I oversee home care services, clinic care management, and interpreter services. These are all key areas that we'll be talking about with health care reform, but that's for another discussion. Today, I'm here today to talk to you about Bethesda Hospital and the devastating impact that the governor's proposed budget plan will have at Bethesda. Bethesda Hospital is located just a couple of a mile or less across from University Hospital, right across from this building. We're actually celebrating our 125th anniversary in this local community. We're very proud of the accomplishments that we've had. We started out as a local community hospital, caring for everything from broken bones to birthing babies to appendicitis. Today, we're a long-term acute care hospital, and we became a long-term acute care hospital in 1986. That is, that we're specially designated for those patients who need intense extended hospital care following a treatment at a traditional acute care facility. That could be St. Joseph's Hospital, it could be Regents, it could be HCMC, or even CentraCare, or any other short-term acute care hospital in our state. Bethesda is considered a Midwest regional referral center for individuals who are very medically complex or have multiple medical conditions. Generally, they require hospitalization for more than 25 days. I want to reinforce that they come to us from a short-term acute care hospital to Bethesda. They're very sick. Last year, we provided care and services to over 2,000 patients. Our average daily census, just right across the street, is 110 patients a day. We have exceptional outcomes in many of our specialty areas, including vent weaning rates, or what we call FIM scores. It's really a functional level of improvement for the patient, and brain injury recovery. More importantly, we are a safety net hospital for the region and able to provide highly specialized care for patients that have life-altering or life-threatening illnesses. They come to us from automobile accidents, ATV accidents, diving accidents, respiratory disease, and they could be on ventilators, trachs, or have a devastating stroke. These are all things that these people really had no control over. Their life changed in the blink of an eye. The financial impact of the governor's proposed budget will be devastating to Bethesda Hospital, the Health East Care System, our local community, and our state, because Bethesda Hospital is a unique resource for this state. Over 50% of our reimbursement is funded from governmental payers, and in fact, 15% from medical assistance. Last year, we had a negative operating margin of 3%, and with the governor's proposal, our operating margin will decline to almost a negative 8.75%. We're, in fact, directly affected in at least seven areas from the governor's budget. This includes DSH, ratable reduction, elimination of the mental health premium, extension of rebasing, elimination of GAMC, and elimination of PTOT and speech, as well as reduction in medical education. Seven areas just for one hospital alone directly. These are all critical for our patients' success so that they can return back to their local communities and a more functional life. The total impact of these proposed cuts for Bethesda Hospital alone over the next 2 years is $8 million. For the Health East Care System over the next 2 years, it will be $36 million. Significant for Bethesda Hospital is the removal of the DSH payment. In 2007, your committee actually created a special tier for the dish, and we really want to thank you for that. We want to thank you for the recognition of our unique nature in this community. We did that all at the same time while we were increasing admissions, and I think that's exactly what you wanted us to do. Our questions that we've had on our mind and probably that you have on your mind is what will be the outcome of this budget proposal for our patients? We are a safety net hospital. We care for the sickest of the sick, and these patients' lives change in the blink of an eye. For example, the respiratory patient who comes to Bethesda on a ventilator, they've already failed vent weaning in a short-term acute care hospital. We have wonderful outcomes. 65% of our patients that have already failed vent weaning are weaned from the ventilator. That's phenomenal that they don't have to be on a ventilator for the rest of their life. With our highly specialized care and wonderful staff, and we have over 800 staff, we are able to have phenomenal outcomes, not only in our respiratory care unit, our complex medical unit, our brain injury unit, or our medical behavioral unit. And we also have outpatient clinics that serve disadvantaged populations. Our primary concern is who will provide the care to our patients if we're not there. Where will these patients go? If the dish is eliminated, we'll have no other option than to reduce programs and levels of care. And I am concerned about Bethesda Hospital as a whole. At the point of this conversation, the question that I must ask myself and maybe ask you is where will these patients go for care and what are their alternatives if this governor's budget goes in place? Thank you very much for your time today and your interest.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Barr. You quickly went through seven different areas that your particular organization is affected by this budget. It would be helpful if I could ask you to list those items and provide that to the committee.
Why don't we just get your testimony in writing?
You have my testimony in writing. I don't have that level of detail in the testimony, but I do have it, and I'd be glad to get it to you. Not a problem. Real quickly, in your packets, this is just a graph that shows you the difference between the level of reimbursement and our costs. And you can see it went up a little bit when we got the dish, and if the dish is eliminated, it's pretty dramatic. So that's also in your packet.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Patrick Lloyd.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and committee members. I'm Patrick Lloyd, Dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. And speaking in opposition to the governor's recommendation to eliminate dental services for non-pregnant adults in the medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care programs, and the critical access dental add-on under the Minnesota care and medical assistance programs. The University of Minnesota School of Dentistry is a critical access site provider for one of the state's largest safety net providers of dental care. We are on a 10-year path to transform our education programs and how our school and future graduates will care for all Minnesotans. In addition to operating the largest dental clinic in the state on our Twin Cities campus, the School of Dentistry also has six outreach clinics located in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. We partner with community leaders from across the state to build four of the existing clinics and are actively involved in the creation of a new clinic that will open this July. Our faculty and students staff each clinic 5 days a week, at least 46 weeks a year, in an effort to improve access to dental care among underserved populations and in underserved communities. At our Twin Cities campus, we had 117,000 patient visits last year, 38% from public program patients. In the metro area, we operate three outreach clinics. At the Community University Healthcare Clinic in South Minneapolis, our students, residents, and faculty care for the most ethnically and economically diverse populations in the entire state. We had plans to expand and to promote that clinic operation, substantial plans. We play a major role in providing dental care to patients at North Point in North Minneapolis. Later this spring, we will open a new hospital-based 5,000-square-foot clinic in South Minneapolis on the University of Minnesota's campus, West Bank. to care for patients who are not only developmentally disabled but who have complex treatment needs. Depending on the budget outcome, that clinic may be delayed or not open at all. In greater Minnesota, we staff a mobile dental van that travels around the state, connecting patients to providers and offering primary care. Last year, that clinic saw 1,000 patients. At our Wilmer clinic, we had nearly 6,000 patient visits its first year of operation from a 12-county area. Our outreach clinics on the campus of the Hibbing Community College had 5,400 patient visits last year from the Iron Range. Growing our outreach programs, planning to expand to 10 clinics around the state, goes back to the year 2000. The effort was initiated in specific response to the challenges Minnesotans' most vulnerable citizens were facing in accessing dental care. The success of these programs is threatened. Approximately 90% of our outreach patients are underinsured or public program patients. That's 90% of 15,000 contributors, participants in our programs. Our ability to provide dental care for these patients is dependent upon the state's support for their care. Because ours are educational clinics, our fee structure is lower, and we can therefore provide more care for each state dollar spent. The proposed budget by the governor puts at risk not only the public program access that the university clinics offer, but also the clinics we are supporting in partnership with other organizations around greater Minnesota, specifically the Wilmer and Hibbing area. If the governor's budget passes as proposed, we would be in all probability having to close our outreach clinics in Hibbing and Wilmer and eliminate the safety net care in the dental school on our Twin Cities campus. The School of Dentistry cannot support this additional financial burden. Eliminating the dental care for adult program patients won't result in cost savings. Rather, it just shifts the cost to medical emergency rooms and other health care systems. Oral health care is an integral part of an individual's overall wellness and health. For example, we now know that periodontal disease not only causes tooth loss, but it's linked to heart disease, stroke, diabetes, respiratory problems, and even premature births. When your mouth and teeth are disease-free, your risk for developing other diseases throughout your life may be reduced. Visibly decayed or missing teeth negatively affects self-esteem, social competence, and documented employability. Unlike many medical illnesses, dental diseases do not resolve on their own. Without treatment, dental disease becomes more extensive, and treatment is more extensive and expensive. Dental problems, like any illness, can cause a result in missed hours of work or days in school. Deferred care can have significant consequences to an individual and to our health care system. Dental patients wind up in ERs. For example, the Minnesota Hospital Association reports approximately 26,000 emergency department visits statewide annually for dental problems. Winding up in an ER room results in greater care needs and higher costs, so there is no net savings to the system. Finally, eliminating the dental access, dental add-on under the Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance Program will paralyze our clinical operations. Designed specifically to care for Minnesota's most vulnerable, needy citizens and those with the most complex treatment needs. Because the School of Dentistry accepts all public program patients at its many clinics, it attracts patients who have not only extensive dental treatment needs, they have complex health needs. Our clinics have become the site for patients who have significant coexisting health problems like diabetes, depression, multiple sclerosis, hemophilia, and strokes. These conditions predictably result in more troubling and expensive dental treatment needs and complicate the delivery of care. To meet these challenging situations, our clinics have been built to accommodate people with physical disabilities, and we have hired dentists and hygienists with unique education and professional experiences. The critical access add-on helps us meet the additional costs we experience when caring for patients with combined medical, dental, emotional, and physical conditions. I urge you to not eliminate the dental care for adults from the public program patients or the critical access dental add-on payment. It would have devastating effects on thousands of people all over the state who depend on us for their care, and it would irreparably damage a network of clinics that we have now that we will build in the future to educate the next generation of a more caring and socially conscientious dental workforce. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you all very much. Next, we'll take Mike Wiedner, Mike Piskey, and Joe Keim. And while they're coming up, just let me remind everyone, I know you don't have time today at the table to tell us of your ideas for other ways to save money in the budget, but please, if you have them, call my office. We want to talk with you as soon as possible. Mike.
Senator, members of the committee, I'm Mike Wiedner. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association. I'm here today because our industry, I represent metro and non-metro providers of both ATS and STS transportation. This is the transportation that takes an individual from the nursing home or from their house to a medical appointment. That is all we do, is to and from medical appointments. We oppose the governor's budget proposals in this industry. We support, there's a disparity in the outstate area, and we support an idea called RUCA for solving the pay disparity in the outstate area. We also do not support returning to a broker for STS transportation. STS transportation, again, is for medical transport only to and from an appointment. The STS provider merely provides the service. Currently, we have a broker that determines whether or not an individual requires this service. Once the individual is certified to receive this service, the medical provider or the STS provider takes the individual to the medical appointment, and the doctor's office signs a chain of custody document and certifies that that person has a medical appointment. In front of you and in your packet, there is a chart. And what this chart represents is it is the statewide expenditure on non-emergency medical transportation. That is what ATS and STS transportation is called. DHS used to run this program with 2.5 full-time employees, and that is in the yellow area that you see. Prior to the broker coming in, the industry, again, in a budget deficit year, and it's in response to Senator Berglund's way to find ways to save money, we came in and we proposed a number of ways to save money in our industry. Some of those ways included a rate cut for our members. We also required the chain of custody sheet in which the doctor had to certify that they are receiving this individual for a medical appointment. And we also encouraged DHS to increase its level of need supervision. As you can see from that chart, prior to a broker coming in, the industry helped save the state $5 million in this program. On July 15, 2004, a broker started. Since that broker has started, the program has grown by over $10 million, and ATS, Access Transportation, which is the lowest level of transportation, now exceeds $26 million, and that the broker is who oversees only the access transportation. I think it's also important to note when you look at these numbers that according to DHS, these numbers do not represent the administrative fees that are also being paid to the broker in this. So the cost of this program far exceeds the $38 million that is represented on this chart. The governor's proposal to broker STS transportation to save money is irresponsible and ignores the facts and history. The governor's claim for the need for this STS broker is the governor claims this STS broker is necessary because the number of rides are increasing, but the STS providers have no control over the number of rides, and the rides are only to medical appointments for STS, and mileage has gone up slightly. One of the things that we have proposed and has been passed through this committee for the past 5 years is computerized mileage. It never makes it into the final budget, but last year when that was proposed, the Department of Human Services found that even computerized mileage would have no fiscal impact upon the costs. Senator, we're here today to try to help find a way to solve the budget shortfall. What we propose is eliminating the broker's dispatching ability and putting the present ATS rates into statute. Presently, the broker gets over $21 for an ATS ride, and with that money, they pay the broker, or they pay the transportation provider, and they keep the remainder for their dispatching fee. The average ride is 7 miles. The broker then pays the broker 13 miles to do the trip and keeps over $8, or 40% of the money that it receives for dispatching fees. And now that doesn't include a bus token. If the broker sends a bus token to an individual, the broker still gets $21, and then they keep approximately $20 as their dispatching fee. So what we're proposing is, by eliminating the broker's dispatching abilities of ATS, the state would save approximately 40% of the $25 million that is being spent on the ATS program, and that's about $10 million. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, Mr. Pinsky?
Widener.
Thank you. Yes. Mr. Widener, for the testimony. I think this chart is pretty remarkable. I'm glad you brought along in a larger copy here, too. It seems to me to be a very clear example of how DHS can actually provide a program and manage a program at a lesser cost than contracting it out and inserting a broker in between and trying to manage services, which just creates another bureaucratic layer and pulls more money, healthcare dollars, out of the system and puts it into a managed care layer. So I thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Mr. Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Widener, I thought that we eliminated the contract with the broker a couple years ago.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, what we eliminated was the broker's ability to dispatch special transportation. The broker still has the ability to dispatch access transportation. And because the broker does what are called level of needs and decides where a person goes, there's an incentive for the broker to downcode someone to access transportation because they receive funds for that trip then.
We just eliminated the broker for the highest level of need.
Okay.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Widener, I want to thank you for coming forward with some ideas of how we can try to save some money. And I will say that as we've been going through this budget process, you know, there's times when I think, I'm speaking for myself, but each member has maybe a pet project or things that they're very passionate about. And I will tell you right now that I'm going to take this on as my pet project to try to get this accomplished, because I know up in I can only speak for my area, how critical it is and how important it is for people to be able to have mobility, to be able to get to their doctor's appointments, and this is so important. And I don't know why we got to add another layer on, and Senator Erickson-Ropes is right. It's just another layer of bureaucracy that we don't need. And so just thanks, and I'm sure that we're, and Senator Lynch is very passionate about this. We're going to be working on this together, so thanks.
Thank you, as well as Senator Sharon.
Yes. All of us.
All right, any other questions? Senator Sharon.
Referring to the access transportation services, how I know that for the STS services that you worked out this process of having a signature from the physician, how is the medical transportation? It has to be a medical appointment. This huge growth is a growth in the medical transportation needs of this population?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm glad you asked that, because the concern of our industry is that all of these access transportation trips are not going to medical appointments. In fact, I have in front of me some appointment sheets which we received from the broker to the Minneapolis Urban League, to Union Gospel Mission, to Crystal Free Church. No, those are not medical appointments. And so what we would propose, and I represent clients who do STS and ATS, what we propose is that if it's an access transportation service, that you also would be required to have the chain of custody document signed. That verifies that that is a medical appointment, and that would eliminate these trips. Nothing wrong with the Urban League or the churches I mentioned, but it's for medical trips.
Any other questions? Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Widener. I will just would like to just note that Senator Sharon has had a work group working on this issue during the interim and into session, and there are a number of bills coming forward. You mentioned RUCA. I know Senator Sharon's carrying some legislation with regard to that. And with regard to this chart, Senator Coring, I'm pretty sure you're my co-author on this bill.
I'm pretty sure I am.
So thank you for helping to bring this forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Let's move on. Mike Pinsky.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. My name is Mike Pinsky, and I have been a special transportation services provider based in Mankato and serving South Central Minnesota since 1993. I'm here this morning as a representative of the Minnesota R80. The R80 is an association of rural STS providers serving 80 Minnesota counties outside of the immediate metro area. I've been asked this morning to provide testimony on the governor's proposal as it relates to the STS industry and more specifically how it would affect rural STS providers. As I understand it, the governor has two components to his proposals. One, the governor recommends the reintroduction of the broker into the 11-county metro area. And number two, the governor also recommends shifting rates from ambulatory riders to wheelchair riders. Let me begin first by addressing the reintroduction of the broker into the metro area. We do not support the reintroduction of the broker into the 11-county metro area. The governor's own recommendation states, and I quote, "In 2007, the legislature removed DHS's authority to manage STS trips," unquote. I would like to state that this removal was for a number of significant reasons. In reintroducing the broker to the metro area at this time would reignite the debates of 2007 and would ultimately lead to a reoccurrence of the same problems the broker was originally removed for. Furthermore, we believe that the reintroduction of the broker to the metro is just an initial step as they consider implementing this program statewide. As rural providers, we have no interest in dealing with the broker any more than we have to. And as Mr. Widener has illustrated, we believe that the broker drives costs for this industry in the wrong direction. The second part of the governor's proposal deals with shifting rates from ambulatory rides to wheelchair rides. While we are heartened and happy that the governor and the Department of Human Services have finally recognized the financial issues plaguing the STS providers, we do not agree with this particular funding proposal either. We believe that this proposal essentially robs Peter to pay Paul, and any reduction to STS reimbursement rates would further threaten access to medical services, as providers would no longer find it economically feasible to provide these services at such reduced rates. This rate shift would also have a disproportional impact on metro providers, as they have a higher percentage of ambulatory riders and therefore would bear a greater burden of any rate shift. In conclusion, we believe the governor's proposals would negatively affect the economic viability of STS providers statewide and therefore should not be supported. As an alternative to the governor's proposal, I would ask this committee to support RUCA. RUCA legislation is supported by the rural providers and is a federal program that is used in the ambulance industry and essentially allows for increased rates for those providers that are serving rural areas and for those providers that have significant expenses due to the number of deadhead or no-load miles that rural providers must travel. The RUCA legislation does not steal from Peter to pay Paul and more appropriately targets only those rural rides that have significant travel distances. I believe that RUCA is the answer to addressing the reduced availability of STS services in the rural areas, and I would ask your support for RUCA. Finally, this industry remains united and committed to finding common solutions that preserve this valuable service. And I again thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, let's move on. Joe Kime.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senators. I had the opportunity on Friday to meet with Madam Chair, and we discussed pharmacy in the state of Minnesota. Now, when we talk about pharmacy in the state of Minnesota, there's the retail pharmacies, which everybody's familiar with, but there are several long-term care pharmacy providers. The long-term care pharmacy providers in the state of Minnesota provide specialty packaging and delivery to nursing facilities, group homes, waivered sites, intermediate care facilities, and assisted living facilities. These people require, many of them don't have trained medical personnel administering the medications, so the packaging is much more expensive in a long-term care pharmacy. And as I've provided in my outline here, our delivery cost per prescription is $3.45. Specialty packaging is 65 cents. Additional labor for that packaging is $4. And that puts our dispensing fee about $8 above your normal retail pharmacy. Now, I'm not here looking for anything or saying that things aren't fair, but this that I provided for you this morning, it was hot off the press yesterday from the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. And I highlighted a paragraph that said, setting the reimbursement rate to AWP minus 15 would bring the MA reimbursement rate closer to the private sector average reimbursement rate of AWP minus 16. In addition, the MA dispensing fee of $3.65 is more generous than the average private sector dispensing fee of $1.73. Well, as I've provided contracts for Madam Chair, why should the state be paying retail pharmacy more than what the private sector is paying them? They have contracts. It's fair. One is fair, the other is fair. In the long-term care sector, I've also provided in your packets the reimbursement rates of all of our providers. And in long-term care, the state is by far the lowest payer. So what I had suggested to Senator Berglund was a two-tiered rate, a rate of AWP minus 15 plus $2 for the private sector. And when you look at the wholesaler tax of 2%, that would put them on a par with what they're getting from the private sector. For long-term care, I made a suggestion of AWP minus 14% plus $4.50. That would put long-term care a little above the break-even point. Right now, we're below the break-even point. If we in long-term care sustain a further cut, then what we will have to do is drop those patients who have a home health care nurse who are not institutionalized but need the med setups and the specialty packaging and the delivering. Those patients we would have to stop service to. We don't want to do that, but, you know, as a private industry, we have to do what's best for our employee and our company. But I'm just looking for something that's fair to both sides of pharmacy. You won't see these things on the handouts you get from the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. They deal with retail. They'll tell you that their rates aren't fair, that they're not getting enough. Actually, they are. You are their best payer. In long-term care, it's not that way. I've shared all this with Madam Chair, and she was kind enough to listen to all that. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen. Next, we'll take Betty Nelson, Peg Labor, and Bruce Nelson. Welcome. Betty Nelson.
Good morning, Senator and members of the committee. I'm Betty Nelson, president of Minnesota Safe Plan, the statewide association for family planning. I'm also executive director of Outlook Health Services, providing family planning services in Chisago, Isanti, and Kanabec counties since 1985. Thank you, Senator Berglund, for the opportunity to speak to this committee about the governor's cuts to the family planning special projects grants known as FPSP. Family planning is more than just handing out contraceptives. It encompasses all aspects of preventative and reproductive health care, including routine gynecological exams, pap smears, breast cancer screenings, screening and treatment for sexually transmitted infections, information and methods of birth control, and pregnancy testing. Family planning helps women and families prepare financially, physically, and emotionally to bring children into the world. 253,000 low-income women in Minnesota have no access or limited access to contraceptive care. There are currently 42 grantees receiving FPSP funding. These clinics provide family planning services to 27,000 low-income women. In addition, 20,000 women receive care through a 5-year Medicaid pilot project called the Minnesota Family Planning Program, known as MFPP. This leaves over 200,000 women who qualify for subsidized services but are not being served due to the lack of funding. The majority of clinics providing MFPP services in Minnesota are also FPSP clinics. These clinics provide a crucial delivery system for the Minnesota Family Planning Program. If the FPSP clinics go down, who will provide services to the MFPP clients? Family planning is a strategic investment for Minnesota. Arthur Rolnick says we should be spending money on efforts that yield a high rate of return. Spending money on family planning is exactly that. Every dollar spent on family planning saves a minimum of $4.40 in Medicaid prenatal and birth costs. Put another way, every decrease in family planning funding results in additional $5.40 of public expense for prenatal and delivery costs. So it is likely the governor's proposed cuts to FPSP of over $1 million per year will result in additional expenses to the state of over $11 million for the biennium. And these are birth-related costs only. These welfare costs are likely to continue for years. Currently, 54% of MFIP expenditures, or $10 million a month, go to families that began with a teenager giving birth. Some say the state cannot afford to spend money on family planning. I say the state can't afford not to spend money on family planning. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Ms. Labor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peg Labor, and I'm the retired executive director of Family Tree Clinic, where I worked for 26 years. I'm also working as a consultant to Minnesota Safe Plan. I would like to highlight for you the rationale that the governor gave for the reduction in money to state family planning grants. What he said was, we can eliminate over $1 million a year because we are having an increase in service through the federal waiver program, the Minnesota Family Planning Program. Well, let's talk about the Minnesota Family Planning Program. Not only is the service delivery of that done by most of the clinics getting the grant program, additionally, the reimbursement for that program is significantly low. It is so low that most of the private sector has chosen not to participate in that program. It is difficult to enroll clients, it costs money to do it, and the reimbursement rate is not very good. So most of them are choosing not to do it. That program is made up of two interesting features. One is called presumptive eligibility, which means that anybody who on the surface appears to be a qualified individual, they can get up to 3 months' worth of service. Within that 3 months, they have to be certified for the other 9 months. So the numbers that you see on your budget page from the governor's office suggest that the program is serving over 25,000 individuals. However, in reality, 40% of the people who get presumptive eligibility go on to get the other 9 months. 60% don't, for a wide variety of reasons. Well, guess what they do when they fall off the program for after their 3 months? They go back to the clinics on the sliding fee scale and are served by the grant program. So eliminating the grant program will, in fact, cause a greater level of reduction in all kinds of ways. It isn't just that the grant program gets reduced and a few clients coming in the door don't get served. It also means that the people who are getting the federal waiver support will have a problem because that clinic will not be there to serve them. So family planning is a health care service, and reproductive health care is a service that people don't overuse. It is not your normal thing within the scope of medical services. People don't get more pap smears than they need. What really you want is that you is that you want people to have as many doors to walk through as possible for family planning services. You want to eliminate as many barriers as possible because you want them to be on birth control. You want them to have safe sex, or you want them to have no sex, which we also counsel people to do. So it isn't a cost saver to cut money in family planning. It will, in fact, cause you an increase, whether it takes 9 months or longer. You will see an increase in cost to the system. So I urge you to reconsider this particular portion of the governor's budget cuts. Thank you very much.
Are there questions? Senator Sharon?
I don't have a question. I just want to emphasize something that's on something that was said that's on this plan or on this paper. It says that 54% of MFIP expenditures go to families that began with a teenager giving birth. I think that's just incredible bullet and speaks to the importance of these kinds of services for the long term, by eliminating the long term growth in something that is already a problem with teenage pregnancy.
Any other questions? Not Mr. Nelson?
Thank you. Excuse me. Pardon me for my cold. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson from ARM. We're an association of about 150 providers of services and supports to people with disabilities across the state. And the waiver programs, ICFSMR, and our members employ about 27,000 caregivers who in this budget would be directly affected. I want to make a couple general comments before we get into briefly into some disability specific. It's our feeling that the governor's budget places an undue burden on health and human services. And at the same time, we do appreciate some of the comments we've heard from several senators to keep all options open and everything on the table. And given the size of the fiscal problem this year, it's not a time, we think, to pick winners and losers. And clearly the governor chooses some winners over the rest of us. We find it unconscionable that the governor would eliminate 113,000 adults from Minnesota care, from their health care. Many of these folks, I'm sure, are caregivers as well. We've heard testimony today about various ways that the budget really does not balance. We heard from on a dental front from Ms. Labor. I'll give you another example. The budget calls for a 3% rate cut to providers. It calls for slot limits in various waivers, including diversion and conversion. That means not only new people, but people coming out of institutions. In the CADI and TBI waivers, places a moratorium on a shift staff development, and it really cuts back drastically on PCA eligibility, about 2,100 people with mental illness. Where I'm going with this is, where will the balloon pop out? Look, in particular, people with mental illness. If they're unable to access CADI and unable to access PCA, where will they show up? Will show up in hospitals that are more expensive, nursing homes that are more expensive, worse yet, on the streets, homeless, maybe even in jail, for just because they have a disease. It doesn't balance. In terms of disability services, there's a double whammy in this budget. While the governor calls for tax breaks for some businesses, he would not only put a 3% rate cut on disability providers, he'd also increase our taxes in the terms of licensing fees and the waivers. I'm sure you realize, and I wish and I hope the administration will realize as well, that our folks, our providers, many of them, most of them not profit, are businesses too. And caregivers, their jobs count too. So to come in and do a cut, we realize we need to share some pain, but then impose a tax on top of it when we're not really taxing anybody else or very many other people is simply wrong. Way back last summer, ARM started developing a transformation plan for disability services, and recognizing that we were going to be in deep trouble, which we are now. And there are some elements in the governor's budget that we think we can make work. And we, by next week, we'll have white papers out on several of them. And I will very briefly just touch on them. Calls for a moratorium and shift staff development. Foster care. We recognize that a lot of people with disabilities who are in foster care or the waivers are getting services they don't need, and we need to create more alternatives. But to use a negative reinforcement of putting a moratorium on is not, that's top down. That's not the right way to do it. We'll have a paper out within next week and part of our transformation plan to work from the bottom up on how we can, yes, save money in disability services, but do it in a way that we don't make the mistakes we made in years past. Technology, call for technology, we think that's an integral part of moving ahead, and we have proposals in that area. He does call for some new funding for COMPASS, the comprehensive assessment, and we do think that's a good investment, that many of the changes that we can make in the delivery system and in making a more cost-effective system will come out of COMPASS or the comprehensive assessment. Calls for new payment methodology for providers, and we are already now meeting with the department on working that through, working from a base of principles that we put on the table. PCA services, we now recognize there are changes that need to be made. We just want to make sure that we can work with you to do it right so we don't destroy the last refuge for many people. We at ARM have recognized that there are some providers out there who have been unscrupulous, and we don't want to waste those dollars if they're doing that. Finally, in terms of a rate cut, and we realize there's going to be shared pain across the board, as much as we'd like to have a COLA, we recognize that there's a very real possibility we'll have a rate cut. And we're developing a plan that we'll have out next week on how we think that you can best do that. The basic part of it is, rather than cutting rates to providers, if you cut the allocation to counties and then allow counties and providers to partner in being able to make sure that those who are most in need and maybe the risky at most at risk with cuts can be negotiated through with the counties. So with that, Madam Chair, I thank you and look forward to working with all of you and presenting our papers and our transformation plan in the weeks ahead.
Are there questions? Thank you all very much. Tony Carter, Julie Ring, and Judith Brumfeld.
Good morning, Chair Berglund and members of the committee. My name is Tony Carter, and I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I'm here today to speak with you on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties, which represents all 87 counties, and of MICA, which is the Minnesota Inter-County Association. As you know, counties administer directly or through contracts a large portion of the state's human services and public health programs. So many of the governor's proposed changes will have a direct impact on county budgets, county operations, and the communities we serve. We understand the difficult choices that are facing the governor and the legislature in balancing the state's budget. The counties also must balance their budgets, and in fact, we have far fewer options for raising revenues and more requirements regarding how we use our available funds. In assessing the budget proposals that have been put forth so far, counties have identified several principles that we believe are essential to protecting vital systems as we contract services. And they are, number one, borrowing liberally from the Hippocratic Oath, do not harm those who need support in providing for their basic safety and needs. And here we're talking about children and vulnerable adults, mostly the frail elderly and individuals with disabilities. In other words, maintain the basic safety net, our moral compass in Minnesota. Number two,
protect the social services and the public health infrastructure of services that we have spent decades building up to serve vulnerable people and to prevent health or social problems from magnifying. Number three, don't put off until tomorrow what you should do today. And here we're talking about tails and delayed payments, which are used to move problems into the future. At best, this buys little time, and at worst, we know that it increases our cost in the long run as we neglect to invest in evidence-based prevention. Number four, resist the temptation to shift cost. There really is no one else to shift them to. Shifting is not a solution, and it ultimately will increase inequities between constituencies if property taxes are used in place of state revenue. Number five, and last, at such a time as this, while difficult economic challenges persist, even tragic for some, they present an opportunity for us to be courageous and to face some of the really tough issues that we're so adept at avoiding during more prosperous times. First, I want to reference some of the items in the budget that counties see as consistent with these principles. Without more detail, however, it's impossible to say whether we can fully support the proposals. And then I'll address several counterproductive elements of the governor's proposal, followed by more comments from other county representatives who will testify next. Some of the positive elements. One, preserving the local public health grant, which supports the infrastructure for counties to deliver essential public health services. Two, dedicating funding and creating state accountability for child welfare by creating a Protecting Children Act. This ensures a reliable and sustainable source of state funding for core child welfare services. I must note, however, that there are some other provisions of the CCSA funding changes that need additional work. Three, modifying levels of care for community-based long-term care and personal care assistant services to best use scant resources. This will allow us to provide services to more of the people who need services the most. And now in the parts of the governor's proposal that violate our guiding principles. One, transferring the balance of the health care access to the general fund and reducing or eliminating coverage for GAMC and Minnesota Care for Adults. I can't stress enough that this will only result in higher costs across our entire health care and public system. Reductions to the MFIP grant are second. This saves very little, and frankly, it seems more likely to prevent success for MFIP than to nurture it. Three, reducing funding for the statewide health improvement plan. Counties do appreciate that the governor may need to retain some funding for this program, but we are concerned that the reductions will make it difficult to achieve the health outcomes and the cost savings that were originally anticipated from the program. And four, rate reductions for chemical dependency and mental health and other providers concern us as they impact our ability to have a full array of community services. And I know that we are perhaps preaching to the choir in this last remark. I would, however, urge the legislature to diligently consider whether the health and human services part of the budget should bear such a large share of the reductions, particularly at such a time as this. The societal and economic cost of these reductions will be felt in many areas, ranging from children who are not ready to learn, to increased law enforcement costs, to higher health care costs for employers, especially when so many will be direly dependent upon these services. So thank you very much, and I'll now turn to other county representatives to provide more detail, unless you have questions at this time.
Questions, Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Carter, I just wanted to acknowledge that, in particular, AMC and MICA have been very interested and very helpful in working with me and my work group with regard to some of the flexibility and mandate reduction. And the chair earlier put out a call again for solutions. And so I just wanted to acknowledge your continued work in that area and look to have some legislation introduced in the next week or so.
Thank you so much for your work.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Carter, thanks for your testimony. And don't take this the wrong way. But a lot of times I've found in my 6 years here that there's always kind of the blame game that goes on. Cities kind of blame counties, and counties kind of blame the state, and the state, we blame the federal government. And in some meetings that I've had with the administration, they said that they've asked the Association of Minnesota Counties, because counties always say, well, it's mandated that we do this. The administration has told me that they have asked the Minnesota Association of Counties, what are the mandates that you're talking about, and we'll get rid of them. But nobody has come forward, at least that I have heard, the like top five mandates that the counties would like to get rid of. Do you know anything about that? Or
I think the work that the senator is referring to is exactly the work that you're mentioning. The counties began the redesign project some time ago and came forward to the governor requesting that we work together with an eye toward the flexibility and the accountability that's needed as partners. And yes, that work is proceeding. And yes, a very long list of mandates has been provided. And there is a focus on key mandates that can help to avoid the deeper cost and help counties to stay afloat, and more importantly, help to assure that individuals within our communities who most need our help will get it. Okay. So yes, and thank you for mentioning that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, let's move on. Julie Ring.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Ring, and I'm the director of the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota, and we represent all of the city and county health departments in the state. As the local public health arm of the state's public health system, we and the people we serve are impacted by a number of the proposals in the governor's budget. However, in the interest of time today, I'm going to focus specifically on some of the items in the Department of Health's side of the budget, and not dive into the 400 pages of the DHS side of the budget. I have provided you with two handouts I think Patrick just handed out to you, one on the local public health system and one on the statewide health improvement program, and that's where I would like to start with the statewide health improvement program. We are pleased that the governor's budget does include the program, but the significant reduction in funding means that we will not see the health improvement nor the health care cost savings that were envisioned by the legislature last year when you put this program in place. There will only be funding for about 8 to 15 grants statewide, rather than the statewide program that you envisioned last year. It seems that everyone, including the governor, agrees that the health care portion of the state budget is growing at an unsustainable rate, and yet his budget cuts one of the core programs aimed at curbing some of this growth, and we're concerned about that. Second, as Commissioner Carter mentioned, we appreciate that the governor did not cut the local public health block grant. And I'd refer you to my other handout on the local public health system and a few of the items that are listed on the second page of that handout. Those types of items, along with property tax revenues, this grant, along with property tax revenues, funds for those types of services in our communities. Third, we'd like to comment on the governor's proposal to fund staff in the Center for Health Informatics, which is charged with implementing the eHealth initiative. This is an important function, but there continues to be no funding allocated to work with local health departments on health data exchange standards. Just like the private sector, local health departments are held to the mandate for interoperable health records by the year 2015. The difference is the public health sector has not received any funding to date to work toward this mandate. The grants established by the legislature 2 years ago were focused on community clinics and other private providers. Local public health departments were not eligible to apply. Without funding, local public health departments cannot meet this mandate and will fall farther and farther behind the private healthcare system when it comes to electronic medical records. Fourth, we support the proposed increase in funding for tuberculosis, which in the governor's budget would be used for 2 FTE and supplies in the state public health lab. Given the increase in tuberculosis rates across Minnesota, this is an important investment. However, there is significant need for funding at the local government level, too. local public health departments work hand-in-hand with the Minnesota Department of Health on case investigation and follow-up related to tuberculosis. And we're the ones charged with following up with people with tuberculosis on a daily basis. Both in outbreak situations and on, there are numerous individual cases that pop up across the state that don't make the headlines. These cases cost counties real money. Fifth, I'd like to touch on the reductions to the Family Planning Special Project Grant proposed by the governor. We have concerns about this cut because the 1115 waiver is not a perfect replacement for FPSP funding as it has been portrayed. Others spoke far more eloquently and in more depth on this, but I think it is safe to say that family planning services, we know that family planning services save us money in other parts of the state budget. Finally, I just want to make one broad comment about the DHS portion of the budget, which also includes many, many changes that impact the people that we serve. We have a number of questions about the proposals to consolidate the assessment process for all waiver programs and the changes to the PCA program. We think much of what's described in the budget pages looks promising, but we will need to see the language changes associated with these pages before we fully understand the impacts. We fully support the goals of providing better training and guidance to assessors across the state, and in fact, strongly made that recommendation to the OLA when their office talked to us. But we're not certain that a new certification process adds value to this proposal, and it costs significant resources. Once we have more specific information, we'd be happy to talk more about this proposal, and I know we, along with you, are waiting for the details on all of those budget pages. Frankly, I have to say it's hard to come before you today and talk about funding for systems and long-term prevention programs as you hear stories of people who are in real crisis right now today. All I can ask is that we think about the budget in a balanced way and that we think about investments in long-term prevention programs and the need for crisis intervention as we try to solve the real budget crisis in front of us. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions either today or at any point in the future. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Judith Brumfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. I appreciate this opportunity to meet with you today. I'm the Deputy Director of Human Services in Scott County. And as a part of AMC, MICA, I'm representing the social services administrators throughout Minnesota. I do have the privilege of addressing the almost 400 pages of the Health and Human Services budget. In the interest of time, I'm going to try to concentrate on just a few areas that we either see as promising or we're particularly concerned about. I want to emphasize, first of all, though, that the service needs that come before the counties are countercyclical to our current economic state. In other words, as jobs are lost, as the economy declines, the need for services at the local level increases. Truly, the local county level are the safety net for Minnesota. And remind you that it's a partnership with the state. The state supervises, the county administers these safety net programs. So as you look at the state budget, you also need to recognize that whatever happens at the state will have an impact on the delivery of services at the local level. So to talk specifically about a few programs, the North Star Care Program, which is being offered to you as a new program within the Children's Services Division of the department, is something that in concept we certainly support at the county level. This would be a single benefit set for those who receive relative custody assistance, foster care, and adoption assistance programs. We see this as something that would provide us with the ability to have more permanency for children, to meet the federal requirements for moving children out of foster care and into permanent families, both of which are very important things. Unfortunately, at this point, we haven't seen the detail of the language. So we need to look at this closely to ensure, first of all, that it does hold counties harmless in terms of the county portion of payment for these programs, and secondly, and probably more important, that it doesn't cause us to lose foster homes that are crucial to meeting the needs of these children. A second proposal that, again, is something the counties in concept favor is the Protecting Children's Act, which looks at beginning to designate 55% of what is currently the CCSA block grant to counties to children's services, child welfare services. This is something that we do support. What the parts of this proposal that counties have a great deal of difficulty with is then apportioning the balance of that grant to very specific programs. As we've talked with several of you earlier in other committees, the more counties' hands are tied with designating funding for particular programs, the less flexibility there is, the less opportunity we have to meet local needs as the economy changes. So we're very, very concerned about designating that grant to a number of different programs. Would far more favor a proposal that said counties must allocate at least 55% of that to child welfare services, but didn't limit the total amount that they could designate, nor limit where they could apportion the balance of the funds. With the way the proposal is currently in language, it would actually add basically a maintenance of effort to counties, which counties have talked to you about, reducing our flexibility. Also, many counties currently spend far more than 55% of these funding on children's services, so it would mean they would, in effect, have to reduce services to children. Finally, the proposal allocates absolutely no funding to adult protection services. And as you know from recent news reports, that's a growing area of need for counties, and it would mean that counties would have to cut funding to these programs. Another area counties have looked at are the proposals, and there are several proposals, regarding the nursing facility level of care thresholds. Again, in concept, counties support these. We recognize that many of these proposals come from requirements that are coming to the state from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. These proposals do help to centralize some of the administrative responsibility and leave counties more appropriately assuring the quality of services. This proposal does, for us, emphasize the need to better clarify the role between the state and the county with these programs. And again, until we see more detailed language, it's difficult to know exactly how it will impact services at a local level. But in concept, this seems to be something that moves us toward a little more administrative simplification and potentially better quality of service. Another proposal that we see as positive is limiting the retroactive eligibility for child care assistance programs. Currently, that's kind of an unlimited ability to go back and pay child care expenses prior to the time that someone became active with county services. This is particularly problematic for counties. It's a very high administrative burden, and there are a number of issues for counties with this kind of retroactive eligibility. So the proposal to limit the retroactive eligibility to 6 months looks like something that would both ease an administrative burden as well as allow counties to better assure that required background checks for child care providers were done in a timely manner. One issue that counties have to bring forward is something that would be problematic to us is the recovery of targeted case management one-time funding. I want to emphasize that this was funding that was allocated to counties based on statute. We were told it at the time that the federal moratorium went into effect, the counties might need to pay it back. But would like to remind you that that moratorium expires in 6 weeks. So in 6 weeks' time, under current law, the counties will no longer be able to bill for child welfare targeted case management. Now, certainly in both stimulus House and Senate packages, there's an extension of those moratoria, but those are for either 3 to 6 months, meaning, again, the current law or the current rule will go into effect still in this calendar year. In addition, when counties were told that this money probably would, there would be an attempt to take the money back that was allocated to counties according to statute, many counties tried to set that aside. But a reminder that at the end of the year when county program aid was unallocated, a number of counties had to simply use that money to fill the gap in their programs because at the end of the calendar, which is the county fiscal year, there was no ability to change budgets. So counties have spent that money, and recovery of that money at this point in time would certainly diminish services that counties would be able to provide because, again, their budgets for 2009 have been set. Finally, I wanted to speak just briefly to the MFIP consolidated fund reduction. You have heard some testimony on that, and you will continue to hear more testimony. but would like to just briefly comment that this will directly impact the ability to serve a population that is already stressed in finding jobs and a declining market. It will also potentially impact the county's ability and the state's ability to meet the federal work participation rate requirements. If we fail to meet those rates, the state could lose TANF funding in the future, which would certainly impact our ability to provide the safety net program to the constituents of Minnesota. The last one I want to address is simply the changes to the health care eligibility. And again, I know I'm speaking to a group that's also concerned about this. We believe this is a very short-sighted response to what clearly is a need to better control health care costs. But eliminating payment to preventative services for both health and also medical care for chronic health care conditions will not, in reality, save money. The people who need this care will simply delay getting the care and then go to emergency rooms, and or we will see people with mental illness being hospitalized or showing up in our correction systems. So the cost will be there. The cost will be greater by eliminating the preventative care to this population. At a time when the state really may have a choice between either restricting a service population or restricting the benefit set, to choose to cut people off a program as opposed to eliminating some particular benefit seems to be very short-sighted in terms of saving money. So with these comments, there are obviously a number of other proposals. Counties have not been able yet to see the detail of the budget. We see some things that certainly would lead to some administrative simplification and would be positive for service to constituents, but also a number of areas that we'd be very concerned about.
Thank you. Next, we'll call on Mavis Brehm, Mike Holmes, and Mark McAfee.
She covered it all. No question.
We'll start with Mavis.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mavis Brehm, and I'm the Executive Director of Westside Community Health Services, located on St. Paul's West Side. In 2008, we served nearly 34,000 patients at 18 sites, including 9 school-based clinics, 4 homeless shelter clinics, and 2 dental clinics. I'm here today to give you a glimpse of the impact of the governor's budget recommendations on our part of the healthcare safety net. Here's a brief picture of our patient population. Approximately 1 in 2 patients we serve are uninsured. 70% have incomes below 100% of poverty. 84% are from communities of color, with nearly half, over 16,000 being Latino. And we draw patients from across the entire metro, with 25% or roughly 9,000 patients coming from outside Ramsey County, especially Dakota and Washington counties. The governor's budget recommendations could not have come at a worse time for our community health center. In addition to the governor's proposals, there are 2 direct threats to Westside's ability to serve low-income populations. The first is the increasing number of uninsured related to the economy, while the second is the diminishing public and private support of our health center. As for the uninsured, the following exemplify the situation at Westside. The number of uninsured patients increased by 30% from 2002 to 2008. Calls to our appointment line have increased 25% in the last year. And our uninsured patients, who contribute on a sliding fee scale, contribute less to their cost of care, a 16% decline in the past 6 months alone. As for financial support of Westside, 38% of our operating budget is from grants from private foundations and government entities. As you are aware, foundations will simply have fewer funds in the upcoming years as a result of shrinking investments. Furthermore, our government partners, like the state of Minnesota and Ramsey County, are facing their own budget crises and may be forced to reduce their support for community health centers. As a nonprofit with razor-thin margins, Westside aggressively screens and assists in enrolling eligible and uninsured patients into Minnesota's healthcare programs. Nearly 3 out of 4 patients walking in our doors every day are uninsured at their first visit. After meeting with our enrollment and outreach staff, we are able to enroll approximately 25% of these patients into a public program. With the governor's proposals, we now have a third threat to consider. Between the 2 proposals that would eliminate Minnesota care eligibility for all adults and eliminate adult dental services, We estimate that this would affect 1,700 of our patients, or 5% of our patient base. I suspect, and our customer satisfaction surveys back this up, that a majority of the newly uninsured would maintain the relationship with Westside, since we are one of the few access points for the uninsured. Financially, this will drive up further the cost to serve the uninsured, which is about 50% of our current operating costs. This may force cutbacks in clinical services and programs, one of such as is the Coordinated Care Network, a project that reduced costs for patients with chronic conditions such as diabetes. It is my fear that a segment of our patients affected by the governor's proposal would forego cost-effective primary care services at Westside and wait until their conditions become more complex and therefore costlier to treat at less cost-effective venues such as hospital emergency departments. So as you consider eligibility cuts this session, please consider the residual impact that these cuts have on safety net providers like Westside. Cuts to the safety net will not cut the number of people at our front door needing services. If anything, our services will see an increase in demand as the newly uninsured seek affordable health care. Thank you for your time today, and if you have any questions.
Any questions? Okay, this would be a good time to remind everyone that if they can take about 2 minutes in their testimony, we should be able to complete our agenda. Mike Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Holmes. I'm the CEO of Scenic Rivers Health Services. We are a primary care service provider, a safety net clinic in northern Minnesota. We operate 5 community health centers in the communities of Cook, Big Fork, Big Falls, Northome, and Floodwood. We have a service area of about 7,500 square miles, and there's a permanent population in this area of about 17,000 people. This is a sparsely populated area. They are about 2.2 people per square mile. We're entering our 30th year as a primary health care provider. We serve a medically underserved population in an area that is both medically and dentally a health professional shortage area. It's a very limited market for healthcare access in northern Minnesota, and it's especially so for low-income and uninsured populations. Last year, we had 13,800 patients. We served about 50,000 visits for this patient population. 31% of this patient population is uninsured, 21% is on Minnesota Care, 18% is on Medicare, and only 30% of this population is has commercial insurance. Between 2007 and 2008, our Minnesota Care population increased by 14%, our uninsured population increased by 8%, and we haven't felt the effects of the downturn of the economy. Permanent plant, forest product plant closures, and we have a crash in the logging industry. These patients will still come to us. There are no other access points for care, but they'll come to us with fewer resources. They'll be sicker and poorer. Patients that used to have insurance no longer have insurance or no longer will have Minnesota Care, and patients that had some cash, some work, will come to us with less resources. The proposed Minnesota Care cuts will increase our uninsured population from 4,200 patients to over 4,700 patients, and the economic downturn will increase our uninsured population to over 5,000 patients and probably push 6,000 patients. The best case scenario is for patient care is that we continue to see these patients. The worst case is that they decline to access care and see deteriorating health status. The last time we faced these kinds of economic conditions were back in the early 80s, and I was Scenic Rivers was there. We managed to live through that two-year downturn, but we went into that economic decline with a 12% uninsured population, and we came out of it with an 18% uninsured population. Now we're going into this decline with a 31% uninsured population, and we'll probably come out of it with a 40%+ uninsured population. There are no easy answers for us as a safety net provider. Our options are to reduce staff, reduce service, and reduce access. Many of the questions today have been, how do you survive these particular periods? The one question that isn't asked is how many of the safety net providers will survive. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark McAfee representing AFSCME Council 5. We have 43,000 members in the state. We have state, county, city, school, hospital, long-term care workers. This situation we face is very serious. It's as if we were living in New Orleans. We've got a financial hurricane approaching, and the governor is at Mardi Gras, or perhaps I should say Fasching in Munich. In the midst of this mounting anxiety and the prospect of the broad devastation you're hearing and you know about that's approaching us, somehow we have to take a deep breath in this long session and determine how we can best keep our health and human services system from imploding. We know we're going to get cuts, but we appreciate the hearing, Madam Chair, and how we can work together. And I'll just touch on a few very quickly to stay inside my 2 to 3 minutes before I'm a boiled egg, and that would be obviously the transfer of the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund. That was no surprise to the chair that the governor did this. It seems to be a big political game, unfortunately. Minnesota care cuts, GAMC, et cetera, that go with it are of great concern. I'll mention one that I think we have to take a hard look at before we go forward because I don't think it shows much cost saving, although it's an important issue. Moving the fraud prevention investigation from the counties to the state, I can say, for example, we have a pretty good program in Ramsey County, so I think we ought to take a hard look at that before we would do that. Judith Brumfield mentioned the recovering TCM funds. That is appropriate, but we need to watch what the feds are doing. Healthcare program simplification, that was on page 113. Senator Lynch, when we look at all the simplification, take a look at that. But we're pretty skeptical about that idea, given the history of health match and the eligibility cuts that are now proposed. One other one very specifically, the pension reform proposal that touches on Minnesota's sex offender program, MEDO, and the security hospital. As far as moving employees off the correctional plan, that issue has appropriately been taken up in the pension commission, and as far as dealing with how the employees are affected, we think that's where it ought to be dealt with. Obviously, there's some budget issues that go with it, as the governor's proposed. You'll be considered those. But as far as the employees, we're very much opposed to that, and it is in the pension commission right now. And others have touched on, I'll finish by just saying we're concerned as these folks, the clinics, the hospitals, child care, long-term care, others will speak to that. So we're here to work with you as best we can, and thank you. I'll stop.
Thank you all. And when
Madam Chair.
Yeah. When you talk with the members of the pension commission, tell them to send money. Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, Mr. McAfee,
yeah.
is AFSCME going to, is your union going to come forward with any recommendations on cost savings? It's easy, I don't always agree with the governor, but this is an unpleasant task for everybody, and nobody likes the proposed budget that he's put forward, but yeah, it has to be done. But so I guess I'd like to see AFSCME come forward with some ideas on how they think we can fix a budget. I'd like to hear what they have to say about a proposed freeze on everybody. Would they rather have that, or would they rather have an increase and then lay off the younger workers? I guess you don't have to give me an answer today, but I'd like to, I'd like to have everybody that's coming forward come forward with some ideas. So.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Coring, yes, certainly we'll have to address the ideas. We'll have some ideas in working with other groups on the revenue end as well. So certainly we'll engage in the conversation. It's controversial and difficult for all of us. So we know if we have concern, then we have to be at the table on these issues. So
thank you. Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next, we'll call on Carrie Thurlow, Toby Pearson, Mary Wellick, and Ann Henry.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota, here representing the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm just going to speak briefly about one area of concern that we have with the governor's budget, and then turn it over to my counterpart, Toby Pearson, to mention briefly a couple of other areas. The governor's budget has a number of different proposals in it.
We could ask that the back door be closed, please. Thank you. Sorry.
Sorry. The governor's budget includes a number of different proposals that impact long-term care providers, nursing homes, assisted living, home care providers. And like many of the other testifiers, we are still digesting many of the details of the governor's budget. Some of the impacts will not be known until we are able to see language on the proposals. However, Mr. Pearson and I have concerns about the direction of the governor's budget in at least three different areas. I'm going to focus my comments on the direction that the governor's budget takes us with regard to reform in older adult services. In the past several years, we've made progress with the help of the chair and many of the committee members in bringing forward proposals that help reform providing older adult services, to increase access to older adult services for seniors, and to increase choice for seniors in Minnesota as we prepare for the age wave. We are concerned that the governor's budget takes a step backwards from many of the reforms that we have passed in many of the years, and I'm going to focus on at least two of them. The first and foremost is the proposal to eliminate nursing facility rebasing that was passed in 2007 with the help of many of you that in this room. Rebasing is an important reform policy that was designed to bring the medical assistance payment rates in line with the actual costs to nursing facilities. I know many of you are well aware of the shortfall between the medical assistance reimbursement rate and the actual cost of providing care in nursing facilities, currently estimated at over $20 per resident per day. We viewed the passage of rebasing, albeit being phased in under current law over a substantial amount of time, as a step towards payment reform. And the governor's budget would repeal this important reform piece in the long-term care system without replacing it with any other significant payment reform to help us close that gap, and we're very concerned about that. The second area of concern with regard to reform is no investment in renovation or replacement of aging nursing facilities. The state of Minnesota funds the moratorium exception process, which is the primary way that nursing facilities can either do significant renovation or replacement of aging nursing facilities. And to be very plain, we have several old nursing facilities in the state of Minnesota. The typical nursing facility is about 35 years old, and it's estimated that nearly half of the nursing facility beds need to be replaced over the next 10 years to meet the needs of our aging population. The governor's budget does not contain an appropriation for these construction projects, which leaves us concerned. I would go on to say that when the state has invested in the moratorium process in the past, it has been proven to be a good investment because it also leverages federal funding and can produce a $3 million investment, for example, can produce over $200 million worth of construction in the state of Minnesota. The last area that I'll just briefly mention is the area of financing reform. The Long-Term Care Imperative has been working diligently to try to figure out a different way to finance long-term care needs in the state of Minnesota. By the year 2025, it's estimated that there will be more than 1.1 million Minnesotans over the age 65 or older. And the governor's budget, while there's a lot of cuts to long-term care and other impacts to older adult services, it doesn't really address how Minnesota will prepare itself to have adequate resources for this population. We know that the current approach is not sustainable, that the medical assistance budget is growing, and we acknowledge that. But we are very interested in engaging in a dialogue that will take us to long-term financing reform. Long-term care financing reform is not a quick fix to budgetary issues, and I don't know that there is a quick fix or a quick savings in older adult services, but it is an issue that must be discussed in conjunction with the current budget. during this legislative session. Financing reform, if done correctly, will give individuals the incentive to take personal responsibility for funding their long-term care needs, which would lead to possibly stimulating the long-term care insurance market, reduce pressure on government budgets, and also increase access for seniors to the continuum of older adult services. So that is one area that, with regard to those reform issues, that we do see concern.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson, testifying Vice President for Advocacy at Care Providers. I'd just like to feed off of some of the things that Carrie mentioned. The second component that we'd like to address is access. The safety net is shrinking under the proposed budget, resulting in a growing number of people left without access to quality, affordable care, and/or services. The tightening of the nursing facility level of care thresholds. The governor's budget limits access to nursing facilities and waiver services through the use of a new higher threshold of needs for those programs. It's estimated that about 1% of the people seeking admission to a nursing facility after October 1st would not qualify. 4,300 clients would no longer qualify for elderly waiver, alternative care, traumatic brain injury, and CADI waiver programs. Of those, 1,100 would not receive any Medicaid state plan services. This proposal would profoundly reduce access and benefits to home and community-based service programs in Minnesota. A second component in access is the elimination of dental coverage for adults and critical access for dental. As was previously mentioned, the governor's budget eliminates dental coverage for all non-pregnant adults, including seniors, in medical assistant, GAMC, and Minnesota Care programs. Clients would continue to receive emergency dental care through hospital emergency programs present with trauma and infections. This would leave MA elderly waiver recipients without access to routine dental care, would move non-routine dental services from the dentist's office to the much higher cost emergency room. And it would require nursing facilities to arrange for dental services due to regulations, yet receive no payments for this now unfunded mandate. Third, elimination of coverage for rehabilitative services. The governor's budget would eliminate rehabilitative services for non-pregnant adults on MA, GAMC, and Minnesota Care. The elimination of service would mean that individuals not covered by Medicare would not receive the needed rehabilitative services. Facilities would either need to cover the cost of the therapy or deny services to residents who need MA-covered rehabilitated services during the course of their stay. Finally, I'd just like to touch on the economic stability. Long-term care is a vital part of Minnesota's economy and communities. Long-term care facilities directly impact Minnesota's economy by supporting more than 142,000 jobs, including more than 87,000 in health and social service jobs. The economic stability of these long-term care facilities is threatened by the governor's rate reductions. The governor's budget would implement a 3% rate cut to all of the community-based programs serving the disabled and elderly, including elderly waiver, alternative care, and ICFMR and home health.
I am going to have to ask you to wrap up.
I'm on my final statement. Thank you. Nursing facility reductions as well would impact our finances. The governor's budget would reduce funding for nursing facilities through the repeal of the operating rate rebasing, changes to Medicaid payments for single rooms, and reduction in the incentive for bed closure. Taken all together, we don't feel that the governor's budget does any of the three things that we would like to see, which include improving access to needed services, continuing the financial health of providers, or third, looking at long-term reform in the financing mechanism. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Wellick, Director of Public Health from Olmsted County, and I'm here representing Olmsted County. Thank you for providing an opportunity for me to testify. In my local community, I get a lot of questions about what we're doing to protect taxpayers' investments and meeting actual and critical needs in the community. So people are very aware watching what's happening. I'd like to talk about just a couple things today. The governor's budget includes a proposal that local governments institute a mandatory pay freeze. The Olmsted County Board chose to initiate, instead of a pay freeze, a mandatory 12-day unpaid furlough for 2009 to save resources. The community regards this as a positive way to reduce costs, retain skilled employees, and focus on priorities. Staff maintain a competitive base in their salaries so that I'm able to retain my trained and productive staff in what is traditionally a highly competitive job market. In my department, this translates into 5 FTEs of work this year that I will be losing and is additive to the positions that I'm holding open due to the hiring freeze that we have. It requires my staff to shift work responsibilities, focusing on the highest priority work in the department and keeping their morale up. But they feel the county is being equitable to them and to the taxpayer, and they're willing to work with this approach to reduce resource use at this time while we're looking at how we look at the long-term impact of this recession. The other issue I'd like to talk about is the statewide health improvement program. The governor's budget funds the statewide health improvement program at 25% of the statewide need over the next 4 years instead of the next 2 years. I'm pleased to see that the SHIP funding extends over 4 years, but I'm concerned that the funded communities will be very limited in number. My department is in the fifth year of delivering the CDC's Steps to a Healthier U.S. program, which is the prototype for the statewide health improvement program that you adopted last year. It's taken this up to this fifth year to really get a sustainable foundation of community partnerships in place, and we're now really seeing the results, the outcomes improve. This is difficult because it takes building partnerships in order to get outcomes to occur. If we want to effectively contain health care costs in Minnesota, we need to reduce the need for health care services. That was your intent with this program. We need to invest in SHIP at a level that gives us statewide results, better health for children, families, and our workforce. As in any time of financial downturn, Olmsted County is seeing the signs of need increase in our population. An example, an early indicator of what's happening, is that we have seen applicants for emergency energy assistance increase. In 2008, on February 5th, we had 217 households that needed emergency energy assistance at a rate of about $60,000 for our county. On the same day in 2009, we had 851 households. That's a 300% increase in the number of people who needed emergency energy assistance, costing the county close to $193,000. So we're seeing the very real effects of people not having enough money to meet their very basic needs. It's vital that the state and counties work as partners to assure that resources are used effectively at the state and local level. We all know that these are real needs. Communication and effective planning between our two levels of government is vital, especially with increasing needs and limited resources.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
It's our inclination to focus on the emerging crisis. I think it's also critical to keep a focus on the long-term system improvements that we need to make in order to reduce the potential for future negative consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Ann Henry, Dan Zimmer, John Jordan, and Kurt Rutson. And we are now to the point where we have about a minute and a half per person if we are to finish our agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for holding these extensive hearings. We really appreciate it. My name is Ann Henry. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and we represent people with a whole range of disabilities, mental illness, developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, in civil legal matters across the state. Although there are many, many pages in this budget that negatively affect our clients, I'm going to just talk about PCA today, and I will provide a written analysis of the other problems. First, though, I do want to say that the legislative auditor has already drawn our attention to this program, and we support the recommendations of that office to improve the program. But I want to really urge that we keep in mind the legislative auditor had a lot of ideas for improving integrity and training and was not recommending eliminating eligibility for PCA service for thousands of people with disabilities. And that is what the governor's budget pages do. The pages are page 63 to 66. And I just want to take a few minutes to describe the people we think will be eliminated. From the pages, we don't have the language, but from the pages and information we've gathered, it appears that at least 2,500 people will be eliminated from PCA service due to the changes on those pages. And for reference, we have about 14,000 monthly average PCA recipients. 2,100 of the 2,500 people are cut off because of a change in criteria. Now, who are those people going to be? Let me give you four examples. One, a child with mental health diagnoses adopted after termination of parental rights due to abuse. This child is very hyperactive, has sexually inappropriate behavior, a history of playing with knives and fire, and needs constant supervision for safety and behavior. The service this adoptive family uses to support this child in their family is PCA. They cannot get anything else. There is nothing else right now that they can access. I'd like to change that, but that's going to cost more money and take time. The second example are adults with developmental disabilities, many of whom are living with their aging parents waiting for a DD waiver slot. These folks do not have physical limitations, but they need prompting to get through a day and a month in their life. They simply need 24-hour supervision. PCA service is the service that family, that aging family, uses for support. Third example, an adult with mental illness. Again, no physical limitations. This person needs assistance to simply get out of the house to the medical appointments, to take medications, to eat nutritious food because of diabetes, and to basically maintain life in the community. Prior to PCA service, this individual cycled through acute episodes of mental illness and hospitalization repeatedly, but now has been out a record number of months because of the PCA service. And that's the access that we need to maintain. Finally, we're worried about seniors who have dementia and Alzheimer's but not yet progressed very much. These folks need assistance. Again, they can accomplish activities of daily living with prompts, but they need help. All these people theoretically could get other services and supports, but we don't have access for one reason or another: waiting lists, costs, unavailability across the state. The second group in the 2,500 that are cut are people who cannot direct their own care but do not live with a responsible party. Now, I have on my handout descriptions of two families. I won't go through those because of time, but let me say, in our experience, most of the people that are not living with a responsible party are in fact living with a family member who has taken on the responsibility to provide PCA service and is being paid. And because that family member is being paid as a PCA, they cannot be the responsible party. We have very medically involved folks in rural Minnesota who have no other option but to have their family provide the service. They can't get anything else. It is incomprehensible to me that we would cut these people off and, in addition, on page 65, call it consumer protection. Unbelievable. So in sum, this budget page, from my estimation, cuts at least $85 million in PCA services, that's state and federal money. It's about a 15% cut when implemented by 2011. We think these changes will cause significant harm to many people with disabilities in our state who do need support. We believe also it will reverse Minnesota's move toward away from institutions. And the reason is because PCA service has been the safety net when something all of a sudden changes in your life. This is what you use to stay out of facilities, and the safety net is being shredded here. We also think this proposal,
Henry, we need to move on,
will cost more and infringe on people's rights. And with that, we'll continue work on the program. I want to say one last thing. We are in strong support of revenue as part of the budget solution. We think Minnesotans are willing to help those who need it, like folks who need PCA to maintain in the community. Thank you.
Mr. Zimmer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'll try to be brief. My name is Dan Zimmer, and I direct the Region 10 Quality Assurance System. In 1995, our community looked at quality assurance and said we need to do things differently. We embarked on a course of saying that the responsibility of quality assurance for services with people with disabilities needs to be driven by the community, needs to, if you're looking at making sure that there's going to be quality and quality improvement, quality assurance, it's the efforts of those people that needs to be addressed. And since that time, we have been actively harnessing all that energy of those communities to do that work. We, for the past 11 years, we've had experience in implementing a licensing system that is quality assurance, but also includes quality assurance, talks about things like quality indicators, relationships, choice, coordination of services, things that traditional quality assurance systems are not, don't normally address. CMS in 2005 came out with the quality assurance framework that we meet the requirements for. And from talking with DHS and talking with other grassroots efforts throughout our state, it seems that most traditional licensing systems are still struggling with how can we meet those CMS quality standards.
We do need to move on.
Yep. One main point I want to address is the misinformation that we are only in five counties in Region 10. Our efforts, we've heard people have been critical about us just being in one area, and we have supported and encouraged and shared our ideas with other grassroots efforts throughout the state. And the information that we've given you on the back page has a color-coded map that shows our three formal pilot areas that we support both financially as well as with our resources, as well as other areas of the state that that are in red that are have different grassroots groups talking about our system and how to bring that to reality there. We have always wanted to work with our state in bringing our ideas, bringing our expertise to a state level. We want to continue to do that. Obviously, cutting us completely out of the budget would hinder that effort. Thank you.
Mr. Jordan.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I am the dad of a man who is 38 years old that, because of his personal characteristics, carries the label of developmental disability. I live in Houston, Minnesota. I've been involved with the Region 10 quality assurance effort from the beginning, and I want to bring a personal statement here that without Region 10 quality assurance, my son would still be institutionalized in an ICFMR at a much greater cost to the state of Minnesota and would very likely have been a person that wound up at the MEDO facility. Patrick now currently lives in La Crescent, Minnesota. He has a real life. He is engaged in the community. He holds several paying jobs in the community, has opportunities to explore other jobs. He also shops in his community, is a vital part of that community. And without Region 10 quality assurance, specifically the voice review, he would have never had that opportunity. I want to reiterate all kinds of people that have testified in front of you to plead with you to change the focus of this discussion away from just money and put it back on people. It is vitally important to understand that it is people that this is all about. People are the source of wealth. They are a source of the health in the community. And our Region 10 quality assurance focuses activity back to the community. Finally, I would plead with this committee to send a message to what I see as a failed system. The bridge fell down at MEDO. Minnesota's vulnerable citizens were actively tortured and abused by the system that was designed and set up to be their last best hope. This is unconscionable. Region 10 quality assurance stands as an alternative to that, an opportunity for you to send a message that business as usual is not acceptable anymore in the department, and we stand ready to bring our 15 years of expertise to the table and work cooperatively. Thank you for your support and your time today.
Mr. Rutson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm honored to be here, and thank you so much for giving me a little bit of time. I talk slower, so I may need a minute, 65 or whatever.
Unfortunately, the committee is over very shortly, so.
Okay. I'm the chair of the Region 10 committee, and I'm here on the governor's proposed budget, page 78. I would just like to say in a few sentences and that Region 10 works. It does work. I've been on with the Region 10 committee for 4 to 5 years now, and I'm having business as usual. Like some of the people said, it's not working anymore. It's time to look at a different solution and a different I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, like Region 10, because it does work, it is real, there are real people out there, disabilities are real, like it or not, you guys, there are a lot of us out there, and if you don't, do something, it's going to be the disaster and cost more money in the end. And we could explain that all to you individually, like we have. And I just ask you to consider Region 10 voice from being cut from the budget.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The time for our meeting is over, so we're going to have to ask the last 6 people if they can get with our staff, and we'll schedule you on another day when we will be taking public testimony. And I apologize for not getting to everyone today. With that, the meeting is adjourned.